More with Sean and Carl on One Dish, One Mic from News Talk 610, CKTV.
Braids and Badasses broadcasting together live here on 610 CKTV, and one of the most badass people that I know, the one and only JRJ, is joining us, co-executive director of the Niagara Regional Native Center. Honestly, do not cross this woman. Yeah. She knows what she is doing. She is a consummate professional in every kind of way, but don't get on the wrong side of JRJ. I'm looking at you, City Council. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fantastic.
So, JRJ, you and I had the privilege of attending the City Council last Monday. Do you want to walk our listeners through what happened, what was the intent, and then what continued to happen right after?
So, for me, it was more of a personal thing that I wanted to do. You know, my last name is Riel. I am a descendant of Louis Riel. So I kind of have royalty in my blood. That's what I like to think of. I wear my last name proudly. I really do.
Fun fact, and I don't know if you've heard this yet. So Wab Kanoo, the premier of Manitoba, is proposing legislation that would formally make Louis Riel the first premier of Manitoba.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, so you are royalty.
Yeah.
You're like the Trudeaus.
Why would you say that to her? I thought we liked her. I thought we loved JRJ.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. But I wanted to do something. I knew that statue was coming up. We discussed it during our filming for Truth and Reconciliation Day. I felt at the time it wasn't a place for me to speak on it, so I didn't.
Yeah.
Until Truth and Reconciliation Day is when I addressed it, because I knew city councilors were in the audience. And I kind of mentioned a little bit of who I was, what my last name was about, and then told them that I would see them October 16th, which I did. And I stood in front of city council and I told them my story on why I did not want the statue there. And with the help of Sean and his great knowledge too, you know, we were very successful, I think, in persuading city council for 12-1. I know there's that one, but I think we're still pretty successful on getting the statue removed.
I think that's a fair statement. I spoke to the mayor shortly thereafter, and he informed me that there were some people that he believed were going to vote against this, no questions asked.
Yep.
And what happened is your words of persuasion convinced them, like midway through that, like, you know, maybe this is the right thing. Maybe we should be listening to our Indigenous community, and maybe we should be voting in favor of that. So kudos to you for making this change happen.
Well, during my speech as well, like, I wanted to make sure, because I knew previously when they did the vote, it was split, right? And it came down to money. And I wanted to make sure that they realize you can't put a price on the Indigenous population.
Yeah.
Right? We're not worth money.
Yeah.
We're people. We're human. And I wanted them to know that, you know, my ancestor already paid the ultimate price. Right? So I wanted to make sure that I brought that point up to them. And I think that was one of the good selling points for my argument.
It was stunning, and I heard the blow by blow from Sean afterwards, and so I'm grateful to the two of you for getting out in front of this. But I got to ask about this, because I'm going to tell you the truth. I've been asked many times by many people in leadership positions, including back when I was sitting in the chair that you're sitting in now, JRJ. Mm-hmm. And what I said is, why do Indigenous people have to get out in front of every single issue? Why can't white people, for once in their lives, put their necks out on the line so that we don't have to deal with the harassment and the backlash and the things that happen? And that's exactly what's happened already with this.
Yeah, it has. So the very next day, I got a very concerning email that cited my work that I did with missing and murdered Indigenous women, which was kind of concerning for me. And I brought it to my board president, right? And that's Sean.
Hi, guys. The handsome, handsome devil that he is.
Yeah, and we talked about it and stuff. Because for me, when you have a white male emailing an Indigenous woman, not just one, but, you know, another one I'm not going to name, and citing missing and murdered Indigenous women, that was concerning for me because that's a real crisis that we're going through right now.
Yeah. So for context, the gentleman wrote an email that was designed for right-wing pundits or people who would be contrary to a lot of the work that Jessica and I do. So he wrote an email outlining the points that were made, but then also offering right-wing talking points that would be counter to that. And he made this connection between Jessica's speech and missing and murdered Indigenous women, and then provided a false narrative to that in an attempt to weaponize the missing and murdered Indigenous women's report, essentially saying that the violence caused against Indigenous women is all men. Like, men, right. Men should be the ones to blame. And, like, this was a talking point that came out under Faith Goldie in the early 2015, and that's unequivocally true. Like, that there's no proof to back that up. Reason there's no proof to back that up is because the RCMP never documented who was doing the abusing. So, like, this falls solely on the colonial system.
Right.
But then he weaponized that against you.
He did.
And he quote, like, making quotations, oh, you're triggered. I wonder how Jessica feels about being triggered about the real truth.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry. I was going.
That's okay. So when things like that happen, and I'm a very strong individual. I'm a very strong individual. And I want to clarify too, like, my last name is Riel, but I'm not Métis. So my identity is very important to me. I am an Anishinaabe woman from Northern Ontario. So I do want to clarify that because it's been put in media that I'm Métis. So let me just clarify that first, because that my identity is very important.
They can't tell the difference between any of us.
but going back to the point is, I'm a very strong individual. I do come from trauma, and I learn to deal with trauma on a daily basis. And I learn to heal from that. You don't always heal. You're continuously healing, right? So for me, when that happened, it kind of fueled a little fire in me and saying, now this is something I'm going to start addressing.
Yeah. And the part that we haven't addressed is the talking points that this gentleman made was disseminated into white right and probably white wing blogs, right wing blogs, which led to threats of violence being perpetuated towards you, calls of violence being perpetuated for you.
Yes. They have.
Yeah.
So I've seen that. I do have things in place, you know, for my safety and stuff like that. But I just find that it's very concerning when individuals have to do that, especially against women, right? I work with people that with intimate partner violence prevention every single day. And it's very concerning to me that when you have individuals like that that don't even know you or know who you are as an individual, that, you know, have the right to make those threats against you and stuff. I mean, people have an opinion, and they're entitled to their opinion. But when it comes to violence against women, that's not okay with me.
And I think that's a great place to leave it. When it comes to violence against women, listen to Indigenous women. Get behind Indigenous women. Stand behind them. Support them in every single way. I support you and the good work that you're doing. I am so glad that you're sitting in that chair. You're doing an amazing job at the center, out in community. I'm so proud to call you a friend. I'm so grateful that you made a little bit of time for us. Thank you, JRJ.
No problem. It was nice talking to you guys.
All right, Jessica Riel-Johns, the co-executive director of the Niagara Regional Native Center, expert on justice, expert on missing and murdered Indigenous women, and an all-around stand-up human being. We got to grab a pause right now. We'll be back on the iHeartRadio Network with more One Dish, One Mic.
I found a low you've never seen. I wish I never saw coming. Hit me in waves just like the sea. I wish I never started running away, but I keep searching till it starts burning, 'cause when it hurts, at least I know I'm learning. Don't forget me in the fire, don't you let me lose a flame.
This is One Dish, One Mic, a podcast, now a broadcast, with Carl Dockstader and Sean Vanderkliss on News Talk 610 CKTB.
For the first time in over 100 years, lacrosse is making its way back to the Olympics. Joining me now is Kevin Vincent Sadi, who is Sandy, who is a dad and belongs to the Lower Cuga Nation Wolf Clan and resides on the Grand River Territory. Mr. Sandy is the visionary CEO of Odahuni. I really need to work on my Haudenosaunee speaking skills.
That's why you got me, buddy. That's why you got me.
Management, formerly known as Kevin V. Sandy Consulting Group. It's a business group that specializes in governance, strategic planning, facilitation, and business development. He is the strategist and planner behind the Haudenosaunee Lacrosse and the founder of Res Hoops, two of my favorite things to do part-time. And that's why we're bringing him on today. Mr. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Good morning, Dano.
So it was, did Carl get the name of your group right?
Odahuni? Oh, yeah.
Now, is that a Mohawk word?
It's basically the same in Oneida.
Yeah, basically the same.
Yeah, in Oneida and Cayuga. Oneida and Cayuga are really close. Like, okay. On one side of Oneida is Cayuga, on the other side is Mohawk.
Now, what does it mean?
Wolf. Or more accurately, it clears a path.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So there we go. So Kevin Sandy is clearing a path, and the Olympic Committee has cleared a path for the Olympics or for lacrosse to be in the Olympics. How does it feel to you? I mean, we really take our lacrosse seriously as Haudenosaunee people. How did it feel to you when you heard this latest development?
Kind of like double canoe, I think, because on one hand, it's good that lacrosse is coming back into the Olympics on a global stage. Then on the other hand, with our Haudenosaunee, and I'll say Indigenous people all across the world, it's we're not involved, really. Like you say, we play at the world championship level, but the IOC right now does not recognize us as a nation for the Olympics. So it's like you say, that's why I said double canoe. Yeah.
So is it fair to say then that the Haudenosaunee, as of right now, will not be participating?
As of today, yeah, as of, we'll say, October 21st, 2023, yeah, we're not in the Olympics, yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. That's baffling. And, I mean, we've talked about this on air, but nothing has ever happened. We've never been conquered. We've never surrendered. We've never been defeated openly in the plane of battle. We're treaty partners with both Canada and the United States. There's no reason why there shouldn't be a Haudenosaunee Nationals team in the Olympics.
No, I agree wholeheartedly, because I think there's already been, we've had a lot of discussion and dialogue with a number of people this week, and I know even we've done some interviews, but I think IOC as well has already set a precedent, because they already allow, and I think a lot of people don't know this, like some U.S. territories like Puerto Rico, U.S. British and Virgin Islands, I know other groups are participating, like people have mentioned Taiwan's in, Hong Kong's in, like the Cook Islands, they have representation. They said, so why not the Haudenosaunee is what we're saying. Yeah. And but how do we do it, right? And when some of these superstructures do not recognize us as a nation, quote unquote, yeah, but we have our own language or our laws or systems or governing structures or land or territories, resources, ceremonies, everything that any other I would say, country/nation would have in the world. Yeah, it's not moi.
Without turning this into a Haudenosaunee Pride segment, we have the oldest functioning democracy. That it predates the United States, Canada, any Western democratic government. The Americans learned democracy and women's suffrage from our people. So, but I promise I wouldn't turn this into that segment. I got to ask you, like, why is lacrosse so important to you personally, Kevin Sandy? Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, I guess for me, it's what we call that onaguatra, right? It's the medicine game, I know, and my Ganose/Longhouse, like we still play the wooden stick game, and it's meaningful for me because, like I say, it's that connection, we'll say, between Owenzige, our mother of the earth, and the sky world, right? Like you say, and it's that aspect of doing what we have to do, giving thanks, making sure that we're still carrying all of our ceremonies along in a good and with a good mind, that Gunagwiyo, carrying it along and doing it in a very positive and healthy way. And I think really that's what it really means to me, is that I think the connection to who I am as a Haudenosaunee male.
It's so powerful to hear. And so I mean I've had the opportunity to see at the Great Law recitals they do the wooden stick game, and it's ceremony. A lot of young men when they're born, a lot of babies when they're born, the first thing they get is gifted that lacrosse stick. Could you talk a little bit more about how it's embedded into our culture?
Yeah, I just think, like you say, with the game, I believe, like you say, in terms of what I've been taught, like it's that gift, right? It's a gift, like you say. And when Sky Woman fell, and people know, like you say, or don't know, like you say, she gave birth to these two twins, and they played these games, played these awesome games that were given to us. Like you say, it's not only the great Peach Bowl game that we play, like you say, what they enjoyed, but they also play, like you say, this form of what the country of every sport is called lacrosse, but the Hadajikwais, like I say, and it has literally so many different translations and meanings. I'm not going to get to that on air. I said, but the whole big thing about it is that game was, what I see, that creator's game was gifted to us. And I think that's really how it's embedded. Like you mentioned, like I said earlier, the boys being one of their first gifts is that Diwa'o Ganya, that lacrosse stick. And I think that's part of, I think, that journey that we're on, like you say, that river of life that we're on, it just becomes connected to their mind, body, and I think in their spirit. And I think that's what I see with the game. I know it's evolved into a contemporary game, but I honestly believe, and I've had talks with Tom Porter about this in the past as well as so many other people, that there's still a power in the contemporary game as well, because people connect to it. It connects to their physical being, their mental, their emotional, and their spirit side. And I think that's what it gives them. It gives them something, I said, that lifts their minds up. And that's really what the game is all about. It's designed to lift your mind up and do things in a good way.
And we know that this game is a gift, and it was given to us from the Creator. We then shared that gift with our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters, and it's about to be shared on an international level. Can you speak more about the game that's going to be played? Is it going to be the traditional field lacrosse game that is Canada's national sport, or is it going to be a box lacrosse game, or is it going to be some hybrid?
Going to be a hybrid, in which kind of even baffles and boggles my mind as well. It's going to be called what they call World Sixes. Sixes kind of takes the element, we'll say, of field lacrosse combined with box lacrosse combined with, I'll say, backyard lacrosse.
Yeah.
It's a condensed field, and there's five individuals on the field along with the goalie. There's only like one face-off, like at the beginning of each quarter. The quarters are condensed to 4x8. Then it's just this quick,
really
fast-paced game that kind of goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And that's, and like you say, then again, that's another thing that we were talking about this week as well, and saying, well, why didn't they just condense, say, field,
yeah,
or box, and kind of work their regulations rather than coming up with this kind of like new hybrid? Because It's still the game, right? It's still the game of lacrosse, the sport of lacrosse that we're playing, but now there's so many versions of the game being played. And so, but yeah, right now, as we know, it's going to be a hybrid sixes. That's what it will be.
That is a crazy concept. I don't even know what to say to that. No, my son has had the opportunity of playing in a couple sixes tournaments here in Canada and a couple down the States. We're actually headed down to Michigan this weekend to play.
Nice.
But it's such an interesting concept to me that they would just redevelop a new game.
I agree totally. I was thinking about this morning as well. And like I say, we have a lot of discussions because my life is back kind of built around, like I say, all of our games and culture and the things that we do. I said, so it's just like, it boggles my mind as well in terms of how they would want to, reinvent it as well, because they've kind of took the principles, say, of our game when they first came over many, many years ago, changed it, adopted, changed the rules. And another thing, I said they changed the rules again. Then when moved indoors, especially up here in Canada, obviously the U.S. kind of gravitated more toward the field, and other countries internationally gravitated more toward the field game. I said, but then now here comes another game along that they're changing again, and now they're going to change it again, right? And so I don't know, but basketball, I coach basketball, like, I love basketball.
Yeah,
but basketball is basketball, right? Like you said, there's not 15 kind of versions. I know there's 3-on-3, et cetera. I says, but there's, and hockey is hockey. And it, I don't know. It boggles my mind that we have to change this game. Stick ball game so many times. Yeah.
Now, when the Haudenosaunee make their final appearance in the Olympics, we're going to be sure to invite you back to explain to our listeners about that. Is that okay?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Yeah, we'd welcome. And like I say, we need so many allies and supporters like everywhere. I know we've just posted something on social media this week, and it's got upwards of 1,500 commentary. How can we help? How can we support? So yeah, we'll need all the support that we can get. And Yama, for your time and energy, and have a beautiful day.
You as well, my friend. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. Okay, Ona.
Ona Nagiwa, thanks to Kevin Sandy. We're gonna grab a pause. We'll be right back with more One Dish, One Mic.
I found a low you've never seen. I wish I never saw coming. Hit me in waves just like the sea. I wish I never started running away. But I keep searching till it starts burning. Cause when it hurts, at least I know I'm learning. Don't forget me in the fire.
This is One Dish, One Mic, a podcast, now a broadcast, with Carl Dockstader and Sean Vanderclis on News Talk 610 CKTB.
You're checking out One Dish, One Mic right here on the iHeart Radio Network, and we are honored to be joined by the co-author of the biography North Wind Man, Clarence Kachigi. How are you doing today, Clarence?
I'm doing well. Can you hear me?
We can.
You sound fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. You have helped create a piece of literature, of writing, something that's out there in the world that people should get their hands on. Can you tell our listeners why they should check out North Wind Man?
Oh, wow. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on here, Carl and Sean. Just want to say thank you for the invitation. North Wind Man took myself and Seth Ratzlaff, my co-author, 7 years to put this story together. And there's a lot of truths in this book story. And it all started from the residential schools. You know, I'm the first generation on my dad's side that has been able to go home after school. And I wasn't raised with my parents. I wasn't raised on my reserve. I was actually brought up with New Mennonites. So saying that, I'm part of the 60s scoop. So this book holds some amazing information, a lot of historical details. a lot of timelines, not only about the residential schools, but about the 60s scoop and the impacts that it had on myself and my family.
And the, one of the co-authors who is joining us now is Seth Retzlaff. You guys wrote this book together. Like Seth, what's your part in this? What made you want to write this book with Clarence?
Well, my part was it started with becoming friends with Clarence. I shadowed him for a day when we first met. He invited me to come shadow him in his work, and we kind of hit it off. We connected and became friends. I was really interested in the work he was doing. I was also working in the social service sector at the time, and eventually Clarence asked me to help write his story. And I had an English degree. I'd never written a book before, but it was an honor to be asked to do something like that. And we kind of embarked on this journey to write his story. So that's kind of how I got involved. And it was a journey in the sense that I had a lot of learning to do along the way. My background is Mennonite.
I think we have a little bit of an audio hookup. Clarence, I got to ask you, you're the executive director of the Crow Shield Lodge currently. And a big part of what you do in your day-to-day work is returning to the land. Can you talk about how that's reflected in the story or maybe even in your relationship with Seth?
Yeah, for sure. Crow Shield Lodge is all about, it sits on four pillars, which is healing, reconciliation, land stewardship, and education. And those four pillars are very important in our time and our place and our space today. Beth and I look at our journey as a form of reconciliation. As an Indigenous man and a non-Indigenous man coming together and meeting, forming trust, building a relationship, and moving forward to embark on capturing some truths about myself and some Canadian history. Crow Shield Lodge is all about taking people back out to the land. You know, as Indigenous people, sometimes we stray off that good path in life. And we're not supposed to shun people. We don't lock people up. We don't categorize them or judge them. And what we do as family and community is we take people back out to the land because the land has everything that we need to get realigned. And I noticed that because I wasn't on the same path I am today for a very long time. I've been on the path I am to 14 years, and it's in a new, amazing journey that we're on. And I found that getting back to the land, being around people, being around elders, being around the ceremonies, the customs, the traditions, really helped to realign me. So I wanted to duplicate that and offer that to creation. And we've been doing pretty good. We have two land-based sites now. We're looking at two other land-based sites because we want four in our region. And we are hoping to secure some land to open up a healing lodge where Indigenous and non-Indigenous people can heal together.
Such important work, Seth. We're already coming up on time. We got about 60 seconds left here. Maybe you can talk about the book, how to get it, and any thoughts you want to leave our listeners with.
The book should be available at local bookstores. If they don't have it, you can ask them to order it in. You can also buy it online at Chapters Indigo or Amazon. Why should you read it? Just based on readers. Oh, did I cut out again?
Yeah, we're having a little bit of audio. Maybe Clarence, you can just take 30 seconds and leave our listeners with the last word here.
All right. Well, you should read it because It's an amazing story. It holds some amazing truths. You know, Seth and I poured our heart and soul into this, and it'll help people have a foundation to move forward in regards to allyship, reconciliation, and healing. And we wrote this book just to help people answer three very important questions. And those questions are, who am I? Why am I? And what is my life?
That's so beautifully put. I love the idea of Indigenous, non-Indigenous people working together to tell a powerful story. It just speaks to the spirit of the Two Real Wampum and the future that we want for our children. Seth and Clarence, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the name of the book is North Wind Man. Get your bookseller to get that book in. I'm going to go and get my hands on a copy right away. It just sounds fantastic. Thank you to both of you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Honor to be here.
Yes, thank you so much, everybody. All the best on today, tomorrow, and all the following days.
Oh, so thoughtful, such good work. So grateful to these gentlemen for joining us. We're going to grab a pause right now. You're listening to One Dish, One Mic on the iHeart Radio Network. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us, Hamilton. Thanks for checking out the show. We'll see you next weekend. Everybody else, we'll be back after this short pause. The shot never saw coming. Hit me in waves just like the sea. I wish I never started running away.
More with Sean and Carl on One Dish, One Mic from News Talk 610 CKTV.
You're checking out One Dish, One Mic on the iHeart Radio Network. And so again, I want to circle back to this point. Someone out there may be saying, I mean, Sean and I have creative license to talk about whatever we want on air. Yeah. To Bell Media's credit, never has a piece of paper come down from the higher up saying don't talk about this topic on this show. They've always given us the creative license to talk about what we want. But I think that what's really important to point out here is that Palestinian peoples are indigenous peoples on their home territories. When there was the discovery of mass burials outside of the Kamloops, the Shekwepemc territory, that mobilized many Canadians to be sympathetic. One of the first communities that showed up at the Niagara Regional Native Center, where Sean and I lived outside for 7 days tending a sacred fire. One of the first communities that showed up were many of the Muslim people in our community, Arabic people in our community, Palestinian people in our community that understood exactly what it means and what it feels like to be displaced on your home territories. I wonder if you can take us back, Khadija, to that time. You were one of the people that helped organize. Thank you for help creating those bridges of solidarity. I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge Patty Kroc and the great leadership that she has shown in our territory. But can you talk about the solidarity between Indigenous peoples in Palestine and Indigenous peoples in Turtle Island?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I do that, I just wanted to mention that with regards to the organizing that's been happening with the motion at council and other things, I just want to clarify I'm not leading that organizing. So I don't want to take credit. That's not mine. There's a lot of people that have been doing that work. I go to support and I attend the rallies, but it's definitely not my credit to take. So shout out to all the people that have been doing the hard work to make those things possible. But to your point, Carl, I think that's such a critical point, especially with what's happening, right, is that the solidarity between Indigenous folks is so strong because the struggle remains the same because, settler colonial and settler colonial projects mimic each other. They work with each other. They support each other. And so Indigenous solidarity is something that is, truly something that stood the test of time in opposing colonial violence. And so, when the graves of the children in Kamloops were found, there was a shock in our community, in the Muslim community, and there was talk about how do we manage that to ensure that we support our Indigenous community members and show up for them. And, that idea of, extreme, horrible violence against Indigenous folk is not something that's lost on a lot of Palestinians or even other marginalized folks that immigrated here, because oftentimes our own displacement from our lands is because of some type of colonial violence or neocolonial violence in a more modern sense. So that solidarity is kind of a given. And I also want to acknowledge that the solidarity the other way, because even now, Indigenous organizations have showed up for Palestine beyond belief. I go to Toronto for protests sometimes, and to see that Indigenous organizations are at the front leading the protests is something so incredibly moving in the face of what's happening. So I think it's really important. And I also want to say that sometimes it is complicated for immigrant communities, because sometimes immigrating here has been a process towards safety for a lot of people who are displaced from other, like from other countries where there is a lack of safety. And so there's always this, I don't want to say allegiance, but I guess allegiance, so to speak, to the Canadian state. And so there's a lot of sometimes complicated feelings that immigrants have to work through and resolve to really ensure that we have meaningful solidarity with Indigenous communities on this land. Because with that meaningful solidarity, one has to accept the violence that the colonial state has imposed on Indigenous folks. And sometimes for immigrant communities where they've seen Canada as kind of like a beacon of hope, a place of safety that they finally come to, those feelings can be complicated. So it's definitely an ongoing process. And I'm so grateful for all the work, you know, that, like you said, Patty and other community leaders have put in to bridge those gaps and to work towards meaningful solidarity between our communities.
Yeah, I can't echo that enough. And that this isn't something that, and this is something I would encourage all listeners to do, is that a lot of the bridges of solidarity were built before this crisis, though at the time, and I don't think that this is widely known. One of the reasons that the bridges of solidarity were built between people that were understanding the plight of Indigenous peoples in Palestine and what was happening in the uncovering of the mass graves was at the time there were actually increased military actions already on Gaza, who were peacefully walking towards the Israeli border and were effectively massacred in very violent ways. It wasn't picked up by a lot of news outlets at the time, but we were talking about it around the fires. And that for listeners here, like, of course it's important that we have a platform and that we're on radio, but it's also important that in your circles, in your churches, in your synagogues, in your mosques, at your Sikh temples, at your colleges that you work at, or your banks that you might work at, or whatever it is you're doing by day, these conversations that we have on a human level are so important, because at the end of the day, it's these are families that are being hurt, that are being devastated. This isn't Khadija and I playing politics on air. Like, we know peoples that are affected by this, and it's tragic and it's heartbreaking. And people need to have those conversations. For listeners that want to have those kinds of conversations but maybe don't know where to start, what kinds of conversations could people have that are listening right now that are sympathetic around their own kitchen tables or across their own organizations?
Sorry, did you say what kind of conversations?
Yeah, like how could these conversations start?
Honestly, I think for anybody that is kind of in this place of like, oh, it's too complicated, it's too political, I think that in and of itself has been weaponized to really silence folks. It's really not that complicated. Like, we've gone through this wave of like talking about settler colonialism and truth and reconciliation on these lands. And, you know, hindsight is 2020, right? A lot of people can look back on what happened in residential schools and the mass graves of Indigenous children and say, oh God, that was so horrible. That's terrible. How could that happen? Right. But then doing that without reflecting on, I mean, here, the ongoing settler colonial project that is still impacting Indigenous folks and marginalized folks across the country, and what's happening across the ocean to Indigenous Palestinians or anywhere where settler colonialism has its, you know, meddling hands, it's not that complicated. Settler colonialism is a project that works to ultimately displace, genocide and silence Indigenous people, take their land. It's about money, it's about control, and it's about advancing the settler colonial project. That's not that complicated. That's been happening here, that's been happening in Palestine, that's been happening in other places. So to start from that premise, especially as we've been having these conversations in the aftermath of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and trying to understand that and talk about the calls to action, it's very similar. But beyond that, if we don't want to get too, you know, technical with the history and the comparison of the histories, I don't think there's anything complicated about a genocide, right? Amnesty International has called it that. High UN officials have called it that. Human rights organizations across the world have called it that. We've seen just yesterday the International Court of Justice has spoken to it, and though there's been, you know, mixed feelings about that report, there's still a clear indication that they agree that what's happening in Palestine is a genocide. And so at the very basics of it, mass murdering people in an open-air prison that have nothing to defend themselves with, and blockading food and water and medical supplies from reaching them and starving them to death, is not that complicated. So I think that's probably a good place to start for people who maybe, you know, don't know or don't know where to start in really digging up the history or the technicalities of politics. I think we can all agree that, you know, like mass killing and mass starving 2 million people is not anything that any of us should be comfortable with as human beings.
You couldn't have put it any better. Thank you for talking about this very difficult topic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, Khadija Hammouda is working supporting important dialogues that we need to have in our territory. There are also community leaders that have organized the Protest for Palestine tomorrow. That's January 28th at 1 p.m. in front of the Penn Center in St. Catharines. Councillor Haley Bateman, who moved the motion, will be joining me on the Sunday Morning the Weekend edition at 7:45 tomorrow as well to talk about this topic a little bit more. We're going to grab a pause right now. You're listening to One Dish, One Mic on the iHeart Radio Network.
I found a low you've never seen. I wish I never saw coming. Hit me in waves just like the sea. I wish I never started running away. But I keep searching till it starts burning. Cause when it hurts, at least I know I'm learning. Don't forget.
You're listening to One Dish, One Mic on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Thanks for checking out the show on the beautiful One Dish, One Spoon territories here in Niagara or wherever you may be listening if you're checking us out in Hamilton, Windsor, Kelowna, or Victoria. We appreciate you checking out our show today. I have a very special guest. I am so excited to introduce the first ever Indigenous CEO of the Canadian Museums Association. Well accomplished professional before this role, bringing her talents into this very important organization, doing this really good work. I'm being joined by the one and only Janice Montour. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm going to start with a question that I'm going to ask you about museums, but first I have to ask you, how many different spellings of Montour are out there?
There's a few, but yeah, there's a couple, but mine's the Mohawk Montour from Six Nations, so it's U-R-E.
Okay, perfect. And then I want to see if I can get your name right, too. Ganadokta?
Ganadokta.
Ganadokta, okay. All right, I'll keep working. I'll work out on the break. All right, back to museums. This is a pretty cool gig that you have here as the CEO of the Canadian Museums Association. How does it feel to step into? I'm sure this is a big job.
Yeah, it's a massive undertaking, and I think I didn't really realize it at the time when I applied for the position. I knew I wanted to sort of do something more into museums and on a national level and sort of bring that voice from, you know, my Indigenous community out to the national. So I was excited, but it's also incredibly humbling and I'm very honored to do it. But it's a lot of work, a massive amount of work in a sector that has really been struggling since, well, pre-pandemic for sure.
Well, I want to ask you about the 67th call to action and some of the great work that the Canadian Museum Association is doing through Move to Action. But before I ask you about that, just broadly for listeners that don't know, what is the Canadian Museums Association sort of mandate? What is the organization? What can you tell us about the CMA in general?
Yeah, the Canadian Museums Association is really the national voice for museums, and we're here to support and uplift and yeah, we're just here to ensure we do the job and continue to advocate for research and professional development for the cultural workers in the sector.
Such important work that museums do now. You had just said that museums are in a period where they're struggling a little bit. I have to talk a little bit about the history of museums that maybe have had to do some work in terms of being a tool that supports our people. I wonder if you could talk about the legacy of museums a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, museums generally are very colonial in structures. So, and their mandate was very much tied to the policies that were put in place against Indigenous people in this country. So a lot that was happening in regards to taking cultural belongings from communities and putting them into these spaces because they thought we were literally going to be a vanishing race. This sort of collecting, the power of collecting and what that meant and taking from communities really over a number, like centuries of periods of duress, really caused, you know, a huge friction between Indigenous people and museums. A lot of them, you know, I remember being quite young, walking into some of the national museums in the country and looking at things that I knew were from my community, but I have never seen before in my life until I walked into a bigger institution. And feeling very like disconnected and then again seeing the labels and that's labeled incorrectly, that's not how we pronounce that, that's not how we say that, and just the acknowledgement of the people. So it was very much, you know, and I thought, you know, especially when I was in museum studies school, going to school for this, I was consistently fighting against what I felt was a system that really looked at a culture under glass, that we weren't living, we weren't contributing to the country as it is today. And so that sort of became my mission in life, to change that narrative. And yes, these places and museums do hold a lot of power and they hold a lot of harm. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to change that narrative through the work that we do at the Canadian Museums Association, but also with a lot of the provincial and territorial associations as well across the country. And some museums are, you know, undertaking this work and to change that narrative.
Yeah, I always feel so conflicted when I go with my kids to museum, Oronitas, and when I see our stuff in any kind of a museum. Credit to the Niagara and the Lake Museum and to the Niagara Falls Museum, specifically in our territory, that have worked closely with great people like Tim Johnson, Sam mm-hmm. Thomas, and other leaders in our territory to make sure that it's great. But when I go to another territory and I see our stuff, I always sort of, like, I don't know if this happens to you, but I almost cringe, like, is this going to be okay? Like, are we going to have a long talk in the car afterwards? It's getting better though, right?
Yeah, and I think there's been some massive changes in, like, just in Canada alone with the work that we're doing with Move to Action, and because we were called out in TRC called Action 67, and it was important that was addressed. And I mean, we still have a lot of work to do, but the work is starting, and a lot of places are really looking and how they present, how they work with community, how they collaborate with community, how their policies are written to ensure that it's more, you know, inclusive, and it provides Indigenous self-determination in these spaces, because that is what is needed. And, you know, we are seeing repatriation efforts across the country, and there's a lot of work happening, even in the United States. I mean, they just recently had changes to NAGPRA, which you've actually seen in, you know, New York, where they literally had to shut down parts of their exhibition because they're now being asked to consult the community before they present their community's belongings.
That's such an important step, and I definitely want to talk about move to action. But because this show talks to a lot of people across, you know, education mm-hmm. and museums and healthcare and so many other levels, like, how important is that piece to find Indigenous peoples in your own home community and to make sure that you open that dialogue? And for non-Indigenous listeners, could you help them, maybe give them some tips on how to initiate that in a good way?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things I'm very lucky where I work. You know, I'm able to work in my territory, and I still travel back and forth to Ottawa. But I work with a lot of people in my community, like Tim Johnson, and I also work with other experts who've been doing this type of work for 30-plus years. And so I'm very lucky to have Reconciliation Council, who are an amazing group of individuals, Indigenous experts, Indigenous knowledge keepers in this country. And one of them said just actually last week, the biggest tool for non-Indigenous people is to educate yourself first. You need to know and understand the truth before you can even do anything else besides that. You have to, you know, educate yourself about the communities that are living, you know, you live beside them, like get to know them, understand their history. It's a hard history, but you have to know that. You have to know the truth before you make that next step and then do outreach to community. But in a way where, you know, you give up your power, you share humility and just allow them to have that space. You know, it's not about asking for a place at the table. It's actually handing over that power at the table.
Such a great way to frame this. Thank you for the guidance for our listeners. I want to talk about Move to Action, and we've got a couple of minutes before our break here. So maybe a good place to start the conversation about Move to Action is with TRC recommendation call to action number 67. Can you talk about that call to action and how it sort of drives Move to Action?
Well, it really asks us to look at a national framework around museum policy, and specifically looking at what does that look like and what does reconciliation look like in museums. And ultimately, you know, the question came up, okay, it has to be broader than that, and it has to sort of, we have to talk about the hard topic of repatriation. That topic, I think, scares a lot of museums because it looks like, oh, we're taking stuff out of the museum and into community. And it's like, well, actually, no, it's if you really look at it, there's so many other ways to look at repatriation, and it's actually a benefit to everyone to actively look at that shifting of power, because at the end of the day, these belongings they're not the museum's. They're not theirs. It's not, the ownership doesn't lie with them. It's been there. They've been safeguarded in ways, maybe not always protocol, but they have been there. But, you know, when you take those cultural belongings and actually put it back into community, the knowledge transfer that's so important at this time, at this juncture, you know, you reflect back on Kamloops and you reflect back on, you know, the Indian Act, and you think about all those things, and the policies were so harmful to our people in this country, that to really sort of bridge that and to have that reconciliation piece is, you know, start doing the things that we should have done, like take some of these belongings back. Bring back our ancestors that are being held in museums. Like, there's so many, you know, and it's like, why are our ancestors literally in boxes in museums? You know, it's not right. And those need to be rectified.
Yeah, let's sort this out in a good way. I gotta grab a pause. We'll be right back though with Janice Montour. We're gonna talk more about Move to Action and some of the great work that really we need to do together as a community. But it's gonna be fun, folks. It's gonna be great. We'll be right back.
It's all coming. Hit me in waves just like the sea. I wish I never started running away.
One Dish, One Mic with Carl and Sean on 610 CKTB.
You're checking out One Dish, One Mic, and so I was part of a crowd of, I had a role in documenting a crowd of hundreds of people that marched from the former headquarters of the Niagara Regional Police Service over to the home on Raymond Street where the body of Johnny Cronkright was found, not by police, but by community members. Hundreds of people wanted to reframe what should have been his 33rd birthday and to remember Johnny in a way and remember that Johnny's life, Johnny Cronkright's life, mattered and that he's important to us. A lot of questions are being raised about the police. I'm being joined by someone right now who is an expert in leadership in our community and has direct working relationships with the police, including Officer Frank. I'd like to welcome Jennifer Dockstader to the show. How are you doing today, Jennifer?
Thank you, Carl, for taking my call.
No problem. And so I want to assume that the new chief of police is listening to this segment. The temperature is being turned up and a lot of questions are being asked. Jennifer Dockstader, you are in a leadership position. Assume the chief of police is listening right now. When it comes to Johnny Cronkright, what does that chief of police need to know?
What the chief of police really needs to know is to place value on community policing. And my text, and I want to make it clear that I am not pro-police when it comes to the policing of Indigenous people. But it is the former police chief, Brian McCullough, who worked with our organizations to make sure that we had liaisons. And in the case of both Mitch and Officer Frank, Mitch, because he's from our community, and Officer Frank, who's not from our community, actually were deliberately placed with us. And we had a chance to train them. And, or in Frank's case, and Frank attends community events all the way from the beginning. And so Niagara Regional Police, this is my criticism, and I need the police chief to hear this. My criticism is, you called when things were so heated. You knew to call Frank. You knew to call Mitch when things were so heated that our community was going to take action to bust down the door. My question is, when Ashley first reported her brother missing, why didn't you contact Frank and Mitch so that they could walk Ashley through the process and we could have found Johnny sooner? And that's the fault in systemic issues. Is after the fact, when things are so hot that you've got a problem, then you remember who your in-house experts are. And that is an example of systemic racism. Only when the heat is turned up do you call them. My advice to the chief of police, you know who these people are, you know the time that we've invested, and in answer to Sean's question, yes, we do need to expand experts in the area of community policing that work specifically with our community as well as other communities who have taken the time to embed themselves in our community, who our communities trust, and actually then you don't arrest them, you bring them to us. That's what we do in Fort Erie, at least. But they took an officer from the Fort Erie detachment to St. Catharines, outside of his jurisdiction, to assist an Indigenous family, but they didn't think of it soon enough. That's where the systemic change needs to happen. When Family and Children Services gets an Indigenous child that is going to be apprehended, they call the Unity team, and that is made up of workers, specialized workers, from both Friendship Centers and Niagara Chapter Native Women, to work specifically with FACTS workers who we have trained in our Indigenous organizations to prevent the apprehension. Systemic change can happen within these systems, but it takes bold and courageous leadership in these systems. And in answer to your question about Niagara Health, with all due respect to our Indigenous team, does that Indigenous team within Niagara Health have real power? I would posit that they don't. And until you give them actual leadership ability within Niagara Health, you're not making systemic change. You're putting brown faces in an already white system.
Let me just make sure that I get these points home crystal clear, and I will extend this to all leaders of the many institutions that we've named, whether they be education, healthcare, policing, child welfare, and so many of the other legacy categories that have been, by the way, addressed by the TRC findings. Yeah. And so let me just make sure that your fundamental point is that it's not enough to have Indigenous people in your systems. You have to give Indigenous people real power, and whether that's having somebody like Officer Frank, like Officer Mitch, who has been accountable to our communities, whether it's them or some other system, it's all rhetoric unless you're giving actual power to Indigenous peoples. Is that the message for the senior leadership in these organizations?
That is exactly it. And you need to expand it to the need. The reality is, with all of the systemic issues against our people that we face, and all of the systemic racism and actual harms that have historically been done to our people, you need to double the size of your team to even start to address those harms and prevent further harms. Two officers of all of those officers in Niagara Regional Police, no. We need a team at this point. We need a team in health. We need a team in police. We need a team in education. We need a team in child welfare. Then we start to make a dent, and then we also need those same systems to be pressuring the provincial government to fund it appropriately to the need, not what the government is willing to dole out, but actually, and secure it permanently, so that maybe in a decade we start to see actual change, because that's the at minimal what it's going to take to stop this madness.
Now, we're unfortunately running close on time. Is there any final words that you want to give to the chief of police, should they be listening?
Be brave and take my meeting. And I'm bringing this clip, the clip of this segment. I'm going to send it to you, and let's talk.
All right, perfect. You heard it here first. Thank you, as always, for your time, Jennifer Dockstader.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Okay, Jennifer Dockstader, it works closely. The executive director of the Fort Erie Native Friendship Center works closely with police, and I think there's a lot that's in there, and so the point that I think, again, I don't want to mix up Ms. Dockstader's words here, but I think the point that is clear is that you have to give power, and we've had this problem with police liaisons. This isn't the first time. I remember working with different police liaisons over the years, and this happens in facts. This happens in healthcare. This happens in education. Is you have this kind of revolving door of people that are in there, and you just get someone trained up all nice, mm-hmm. and you get to the point where they've come to our communities, and when you think of our history as a people, that relationship is so important. If you and I are friends, even what we were saying about Sam Thomas earlier in the show, like, yeah, we could disagree with that guy left, right, and center. We cared about each other. We cared about the kids in community. We're genuinely invested in them. And so to take it back to these larger systems of control that are here, you know, I don't know. I have the luxury of not having to work directly with the police. Yeah. I can come from the outside and be critical. Our friendship centers don't have that luxury, because unfortunately police are still involved with our lives because we're made to be vulnerable. So I think there's some logic to the point that Ms. Dockstader was making just now.
I agree. Like, so the thing that we have to ask ourselves, or the thing that we need to consider, is that friendship centers are on the front lines, and they are not afforded the opportunity to think system-wide changes, right? Jennifer Dockstader spoke to a problem that exists now. Jennifer Dockstader presented a very clear solution to that problem.
Yeah.
We are afforded, as commentary, as political commentators, to think above and beyond.
Yeah.
Right? We're afforded the concept to defunding the police, to reimagining what a police force would look like. And oftentimes those two ideologies don't mix well together. But I thank Jennifer for thinking outside of the box. I thank Jennifer for finding a solution within the current system that exists.
Jill texted in too, and I want to read Jill's text. Frank was called by the police force and went in on his day off to support the family. This is fact, as I spoke to this officer myself last week. Yeah. He went from his area in Fort Erie to do this. So thank you for that. You know, thank you for that point.
I really want to highlight that the officers who were there last Saturday, a week ago today, I think did an exceptional job and honoring the wishes of the family. When the body was carried out, forensics took the moment to pause. Police officers took a moment to pause so proper ceremony could be done. The officers went above and beyond in that regard. That does not change the overall issue with policing and the systemic racism that exists. There are good cops. There are bad cops, but the issue is the system of policing itself.
Well put. We're going to grab a pause. I don't know. Maybe we'll jump over to something. We were all there.
Though. Oh, you know,
we were all there. That's what, you know.
We got the text like literally a week ago today. I got the text.
Jen was there. Jill was there. Yeah. I was there. You were there. Like, we were right in the middle of this. So this isn't just a story. This is our life. So.
I grew up with Johnny.
Yeah.
Like, Johnny is a childhood friend. I grew up with his older brothers. He grew up with my brother, Taylor, Johnny, Ashley. We would all be running the streets together when we were younger. This is personal.
Let's grab a pause. We'll be right back. You gotta lose before you win.
This is One Dish, One Mic, a podcast, now a broadcast, with Carl Dockstader and Sean Vanderclist on News Talk 610 CKTB.
Dominic Jovanez, one of who's the host. Make your ears in a good way and check out the show. Wakana hei ladu gaika. Wane sadeji waniso gali wagatsununi ji wagata chade. Love starting the second hour of the show with a little bit of language. But I also love having very special people. Ace and Abby is going to be opening for Dan Mangan coming to the First Ontario Performing Arts Center on Sunday, October 29th. You can get your tickets at firstontariopac.ca. You can do that while you listen to the one and the only multi-instrumentalist, producer, singer, songwriter, OG Cree, sensation, sucker clan of Sandy Lake, First Nation in Northwestern Ontario, the one and only Ace and Abby. How are you doing today on this beautiful, beautiful day, my new friend?
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me. I'm currently in my isolated sound booth, a.k.a. the washroom of the tour bus.
Yeah, the audio sounds fantastic, and we'll just assume that if we hear anything, those are sound effects that
yeah.
by design.
I'm good. Today is day two for me, or day three, I guess. We played a show last night and played a show the night before. It's been great. Like, I was actually fully prepared. I thought I was going to be, like, renting a car and, like, driving behind the bus all night. So being on the bus and kind of getting to, like, join everybody is pretty awesome. And, I've never been on, like, a headline tour of this scale to kind of see how it all works. So it's been cool so far.
Fantastic. For listeners that haven't had a taste of the sound that is Ace and Abby, the musical sensation, can you describe from an audio standpoint what listeners can expect to hear when they everybody that's listening right now better be at that show. Yes, threatening people. That's what we've come down to on One Dish, One Mic. What are they going to hear on October 29th at the First Ontario Performing Arts Center?
They're going to hear songs that they're not going to be able to hear anywhere else. I am playing solo, but I do have like this really kind of intricate kind of pedal setup. So I think it takes people off guard a little bit because they just see like a guy walk up with his acoustic and then they kind of just expect to hear that. But then I pulled the rug out from everybody and surprised them with a million this wall of sound, which sounds a lot better than a wall of sound. But we put out a new EP, and these are kind of songs of kind of love and heartbreak, and I'd actually written kind of dozens of these songs, so I'm actually performing a lot of the songs that actually didn't make the EP. So if you come out, you can hear tracks that are kind of written in the same era of music, which is this year.
And speaking of your new EP, which dropped yesterday, entitled Here and Now, listeners can get a preview of what they're going to expect from this upcoming show. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I'll be playing some of those tracks a bit stripped down. So, if you want to come and hear them, kind of in their essence and kind of where they were born, I guess it would be a good time to come do that. Before we start kind of touring these new songs as a full band later, so
can you talk about your story a little bit and your journey into music and what your music means to you?
Yeah, I've always kind of I grew up kind of making music. I picked up the guitar when I was 12. I grew up in this kind of secluded house in just really far rural northern Ontario. And I grew up in this place without electricity and kind of like a guitar. There was a guitar there, so I started learning how to write songs and play songs and just never stopped. I kind of had these few near-death experiences, which kind of pushed me to move to Toronto. And then I moved to Toronto to play music. Ended up going to school here as well for not music. And In 2020, I just when everything shut down, I thought, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to make it as a musician. But I knew I wasn't going to stop making music, and that's like it's something I always, it fills my cup. And I started just making music that was representative of who I am, and it was kind of freeing to kind of just make.
Did you say that you've unfortunately, and I want to be very careful about this, and you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but do you say that you've had near death experiences that have influenced your music?
Yeah. Like I used to work up north, and I think I had fallen through the ice, but I had like a lot of close calls of just kind of, not getting the gory details, but like, yeah, I've had interactions like bears, wolves, and like, we always worked with sharp tools, so like, I accidentally cut myself a few times, but it was falling through the ice that was kind of the one that kind of pushed me to kind of leave what I was doing and pursue music and fall through the ice in far, far northern Ontario where it gets down to like minus 50 and, time kind of stood still for a second while I was trying to get myself out of this river and like the ice kept breaking and then, I had made it across and I had made this promise that like if I had gotten out of there, I was going to do something different with my life, and so I got out of there, and then moved to Toronto shortly after.
Life in Northern Ontario is extremely different compared to what we know down here in Southern Ontario. My apologies, Northwestern Ontario. And you mentioned that you almost didn't continue on with music, but looking at your biography, you were shortlisted for the 2023 Polaris Prize. You're winner of three 2023 Summer Solstice Indigenous Music Awards for Artistic Video, Pop Alternative Rock Album of the Year, and Rising Star, winner of the 2023 Jim Beanie Indie Award for Indigenous Artist of the Year, as well as the winner of the 2023 Canadian Live Music Award for New Touring Artist of the Year. So I think the world is a better off place knowing that you made that decision to continue on and pursuing your musical accolades. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was just so wild that this whole year has happened. Because even when I was making the record, like I didn't think any of this would happen. But it was kind of just working with community and working with like Ishkade Records, and some Indigenous owned label, right? And so it was like making this record and just like uncompromisingly. So it was so interesting just working with other Indigenous people where suddenly you just kind of like didn't have to explain anything. Like they just kind of got it and they're like, all right, we're doing it, it's been a crazy year, and it's like hasn't quite stopped. So I'm still kind of. I think this winter, I like purposely kind of stopped kind of taking events and stuff to kind of just sit and reflect, and also work on some R&D music for everybody. And so it's been a wild year, and I'm like just eternally grateful that I get to kind of do this with my life.
And you're on tour with Dan Mangan, who had the opportunity to attend one of his concerts a couple years back when he's at the Performing Arts Center, and he is no joke of a performer. He is fantastic.
He's incredible, and it was crazy too, because like my first time meeting him was, and like actually having like a conversation with him was in Texas earlier this year, like in April, I think, or maybe it was late March. It was for South by Southwest, and then Laura Simpson had come out to my show. It's funny because like the juxtaposition of the show was kind of just like going to the U.S. I always find it so humbling because the night before we had kind of played to like 15,000 people at this arena in Edmonton for the Juno's broadcast, and then the next day we flew to Texas to play, to Austin, Texas, to play South by Southwest. And I was playing this patio, and I was playing to, to set the scene, like, it was just like, I was on this patio, on the other side of this wooden fence was like this EDM dance party. Oh, my earbud just fell out. I hope I don't lose you putting this thing back in.
So far, so good.
And then on the other side is like this really hype hip hop show, and then I'm there with my acoustic guitar, no band, playing to 15 people on this patio, trying to fight for noise. And I finish playing, and then there's just like torrential downpour, and there's this tornado warning. And so we're all kind of like corralled into this tiny little venue that I was playing at, and we're like shoulder to shoulder. And that's like Dan was there. And then, so that's kind of, he was forced to hang out with me. And it was good. And you know, now we're touring. Now we're touring.
Absolutely fantastic. And so the next opportunity, everybody can go see you on Sunday, October 29th at the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre. Thank you so much for joining us, Ace and Abby.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, Ace and Abby, again, one last time, the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre, October 29th. Grab your tickets now. It's going to be a red-hot show. And I've had this happen a million times before,
yeah,
where people like go for the headliner, but it turns out that the person opening for them ends up just yeah, crushing it. This is going to be one of those instances. Ace and Abby is back in our territory, having been here yeah, before, and you're going to want to get the tickets.
Dan Magan is no slouchy. He is a fantastic performer. We went there before, and like I was in awe. I never knew who he was until that. So this is an all-star lineup. Like, shout out to the Performing Arts Center for getting both Ace and Abby and Dan Magan performing together.
On one ticket. That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
I might actually pay for tickets.
We're going to have a pause here on One Dish, One Mic. We'll be right back. Because when it hurts, at least I know I'm learning. Don't forget me in the fire. Don't you let me lose a flame. So
you're listening to Carl Dockstader on the Voice of Niagara, News Talk 610 CKTB. Text Carl Dockstader at 61010.
You're checking out One Dish, One Mic on the iHeart Radio Network. Thank you so much to our friends that are listening in Niagara, Hamilton, Windsor, Victoria, and Kelowna. How's it going out on the West Coast? Hope you're having a good time out there. Hope you're having a good time listening to the show. I always have a great time. Honestly, every single time I talk to this person, I feel like I have learned more about the world and I've become just a little bit smarter because she just carries so much knowledge. Courtney Skye is a Mohawk Turtle Clan from Six Nations of the Grand River Territory. She works with Yellowhead. She does so much great work in her home community in Six Nations. I have personally witnessed all of the stuff that Courtney Skye does, for which she receives no thanks and seeks no thanks, but still makes our people better. I am deeply honored that you're on the show. Thank you so much for joining us, Courtney Skye.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
It's an honor to have you, but let's get right to business and talk about We Remain Certain, an amazing show that's happening at the McMaster Museum of Art. You were part of an exhibition and an opening on Thursday. Can you tell us a little bit about the show?
Yeah, so We Remain Certain is a contemporary art show showing the Haudenosaunee connection to the Grand River watershed. And so it explores, you know, utilizing what our contemporary artists, creators, photographers, how we're interpreting, expressing our connection to our land and our history, and, you know, re-expressing our original instructions, our, you know, pre-contact knowledge of our ways that our nations came to exist, and having a contemporary conversation around and utilizing art to talk about land stewardship along the Grand River. How are we caretaking the Grand River? How are we preparing ourselves and future generations to deal with the impacts of climate change very locally, and using the museum space as a jumping off point for that conversation?
It's such a great idea, and I'm going to get down there. I regret that I couldn't come to the opening reception itself. But I actually want to start at when you look at the flyer that you sent me to talk about this event and that's been circulated widely around. It starts off in the language, and so I kind of want to start there. That I think it's a neat idea that it's not maybe spoon fed to people an easy catchy title in big bold letters. It starts off in Cayuga language and Mohawk language and our words. How important is that to this exhibit?
It's so important. And I think that when we talk about you know, the conversations that we're having around land and respecting Indigenous sovereignty and all those things. Like, there are many different conversations that happen at many different levels. And for Protect the Tract, we've always tried to privilege and prioritize the conversations that our own community is having, whether it be from land defenders or traditional knowledge keepers or language speakers, that they feel reflected too, that there's a, that this exhibit has a depth to it where, you know, people who are not familiar with Haudenosaunee people at all are going to be able to come in and learn something and take something away, but also Haudenosaunee people who understand all of the cultural cues and depths and language are going to be also included in a provocative conversation around thinking more critically about where we are in our point in history. So I think that that's, you know, the language was very much a part of that, but also, you know, not just for Protect the Tract in doing transformational work, but we really try to change, you know, the status quo with how we do our work ourselves. And so that includes rethinking how things like translation and, you know, beadwork and how all these things happen. Typically, sometimes they're like one-on-one or very solo, very isolating. And that isolation, that singular person being an expert knowledge person, is brought kind of from capitalism, you know, capitalistic, individualistic nature. And so we try to take our practices as well and make them more collective. So the language component of this exhibition has actually included a collaborative effort where we have language speakers at all different levels, from people who would, you know, be considered very high level speakers to very introductory level speakers, translating and working together alongside each other. And actually our translation events have had Huga and Mohawk speakers translating from English into their languages alongside each other, so that we're able to generate new conversations and different kind of dynamics in a way that feels really restorative and making ourselves whole on our own terms in our own way.
It's so important, and I have to shout out a lot of the language speakers that are out there. I was talking to a friend from Six Nations. Many of these people learning language are not receiving any kind of compensation. There's no pay. There's no job to go and learn language. Often you're quitting a better job to go and to live with an elder and to make the sacrifice, and they're just doing it for the betterment of our people. I have to acknowledge that the fact that we have Indigenous languages that are starting to get stronger with every single day is because of the sacrifice of so many people and the strength of our people. And it's so important. And it's, so it's reflected in this art and in this gallery. I did recognize, I thought I saw some Cornhusk dolls from Bette Stockstader. I thought I saw some work from Dakota Brandt on the walls. It seems like a real powerhouse collective that's come together for this.
Yes, for sure. So we had, you know, this work centers around this beaded map that we've been working for 3 years to create. You know, when Protect the Tract was, you know, first conceptualized by myself and my co-director, Todd Williams, and the people that we were around at the time, you know, emerging out of 1492 Lambeck Lane, we really wanted to, you know, we really challenged ourselves to think of, you know, if we're telling the story of the Grand River, if we're talking about land tenure, if we're talking about our connection to the river, it had, if we wanted to show that to people and a map, like, it had to be the most beautiful map you've ever seen in your life. And for me, that became very obvious that it was a raised beaded map. And so we've been developing, you know, our own capacity, recruiting artists and things like that to be able to create this giant beaded map to show our connection to the river. And then in mounting the exhibition, it became, well, contextualizing the map. You know, what do people need to understand about Haudenosaunee people, culture, worldview, to be able to understand and learn from this map? And so that everything that comes from this piece is, or from the exhibition, is really there in service to help amplify the map conversation that can happen there. But so we did a call out for new collaborations from other artists. So Dakota Brandt, Kristen Summers, Kaya Hill were artists that answered that call and submitted ideas for new work created specifically for this exhibition along the themes that we were looking to explore. We had an advisor and curatorial collective of community members, elders, academics, who pulled together existing works from established artists, like you're saying, Bette Stockstader, Greg Stott, Jeff Thomas, Shelley Nero, Arnold Jacobs, like those folks, you know, Steve Thomas, Rick Hill,
And then our collective of artists, both the beadwork artists, but then also high tanners and our activists, you know, map making people that are with Protect the Tract that did, you know, some of the photography, some of the videography, curating some of the other pieces that complement this story around, you know, very specific maps that are new and rediscovered for this exhibition to be able to tell these stories.
Truly amazing work. And so just in case, and sometimes I get accused of being too Haudenosaunee-centric on the show a little bit, but I love to explain to people, you'd mentioned raised beadwork specifically. Like, why raised beadwork on the map?
Well, raised beadwork is something that is distinctly Haudenosaunee. Ever since, you know, colonists brought beads to this region, Haudenosaunee people, and specifically Tuscarora Nation, had generated this very distinct style of artwork. So it's something that, you know, is born out of the Tuscarora Nation that's traveled across all of our nations. You know, every Haudenosaunee person does raise beadwork. We also partnered with Grant Jonathan, who is a collector and historian of Haudenosaunee and Tuscarora raised beadwork, and he was a huge support to the work that we're doing. And Grant made these really clear points of, like, ever since we developed this style of art, it's never needed to be revitalized. It has always existed in our community. It has always been practiced. There's never been, like, a reclamation or a revitalization of it. It's always existed. And I think that's something that's really important, too, that, you know, through residential school, through displacement, through all this police violence, there was still this art form that was maintained in our nations and spread and existed. And we have that connection. And that art form has evolved. You know, contemporary beadwork looks much different than the beaded map and how this beadwork was developed. So the revitalization and the reclamation that happened through this project was looking back at these original beadwork artists, you know, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, who developed the style and how they did their art, and taking on and studying what they had created to be able to build this map in their image, to pull forward, like to pull into the contemporary, all of these different generations of work that have happened. So, you know, the raised beaded map is done with beads that have been sourced from, you know, from Europe, from Vienna. They're handmade glass beads that are 150 years old. These are the beads that our grandmothers would have been working with to create their beadwork, to be able to bring in a modern take on some of that historical beadwork style.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you for sharing. The McMaster Museum of Art is presenting We Remain Certain from January 11th until March 22nd of 2024, partnering with Protect the Tract. We're going to grab a short pause, and then I'm going to talk with Courtney about what exactly is Protect the Tract. We'll be right back after this short pause.
I found a low you've never seen. I wish I never saw coming. Hit me in waves just like the sea. I wish I never started running away. But I keep searching till it starts burning. Cause when it hurts, at least I know I'm learning. Don't forget.